everyone. This is Cameron Marceau doing another episode of Monster in a Glass, part of the Black Liver Project, where we're going through cocktails. We went through all of the really obvious classics. Now we're going through forgotten cocktails in Vintage Spirits and Forgotten Cocktails, a little book by Mr. Ted Haig. And we're just going through them because why the hell not? Because I love tasting new things, and quite frankly, this book is loaded with strange concoctions, different liqueurs, all these just, it's really fun and interesting. So I'm sitting here with Black Liver Project's researcher and historian, Jason Cruz, who's done a little looking into our next cocktail, which is called the East India Cocktail.
So the East India Cocktail is, as Ted Haig says, came from the Harry Johnson's New and Improved Bartender's Manual of 1882. One thing that he mentions is that the recipe, which calls for brandy, raspberry syrup, this is in Haig's book, brandy, raspberry syrup, Angostura bitters, orange curacao, and maraschino liqueur.
That all sounds so good.
Yeah, it sounds sweet. He says that that manual uses pineapple syrup instead of raspberry. And actually, he's wrong. There's an issue with Harry Johnson's book. It originally was published in 1882, which is the first edition, but it was republished in 1888 and 1935, so there's multiple editions out. The problem is that the 1888 edition, or the 1935 edition, actually, sometimes looks like it is from 1882. It'll say 1882, but it's actually the reprint. So I think that's where he's getting confused, because the 1882 edition does, in fact, use raspberry syrup. The 1888 edition and the 1935 of Harry Johnson's book uses pineapple syrup. It also uses red curacao, which I'm not sure what the difference between orange and red. We looked into this before with looking at the curacao, but I don't, maybe it's just a different food color.
Yeah. I mean, they have blue curacao too, yeah. And that's just purely.
So I don't know if it's intentional in the recipe.
Wait, did you say that the pineapple syrup came earlier or later?
Later.
Yeah. And what would be the date on that?
At least 1888, as far as I can tell. The 1882 edition
has a little early for the pineapple mm-hmm. craze.
And it's syrup. So I think during around Prohibition, when fruit juice was becoming more popular, but it's the syrup. And I think that all these fruits, there was, you know, the syrup is, I don't know, I couldn't place a time frame on it. And it's only a few short years between reprints, so, or, you know, I guess it wouldn't be an exact reprint since the recipe changed, a new version.
So this is most likely Harry Johnson's drink.
As far as I can tell, it is weird because he does put a note in the 1888 edition, well, actually, it's just in the 1935. This drink is a favorite with the English living in different parts of East India. This does not appear in the 1882 edition. So, again, I'm not sure what in between those 6 years changed.
He said, okay, so he said that the people in India,
the English living in India,
enjoyed this.
Right.
There's not a lick of gin in there. I would expect everything they drank.
Right. And, yeah. I mean, that's why.
But, you know.
When I started looking at when I read that, and I was like, okay. So I started looking into it, and I thought, maybe it's possible this was because of the brandy. Maybe it was something that was popular in Britain and moved.
Yeah, that's entirely possible.
But in between that time period, 1882 and 1888, the recipe actually changes. So he also calls for a cherry or an olive in 1935, which those are different.
Yeah, that's like really different.
I don't know why you would recommend one or the other. It seems like you would recommend like a cherry.
It does not look like an olive drink.
Mm-mm.
Not one little bit.
It's red.
And looking at all the ingredients, the primary profile is like sweet.
Mm-hmm.
There's no burn. There's no sour or salty.
The only thing I could assume is maybe, because most of the drinks that I found, and they probably are all based or loosely based on Johnson's recipe, called for a cherry. The only thing I could think of is that in the olive, maybe it offset the taste of the sweetness with all the, you know, maybe it added some
salt. Or maybe they had sweet olives.
Good. Sweet olives. Huh?
Maraschino olives.
That would look really gross. I'm sure you could do it, though.
Put them on your sundae.
Yeah.
Mm.
Worst Sunday ever.
A pickle split.
a pickle spray. That'll be on the next Monster in a Glass.
That's, yeah. We'll have alternate Sunday flavors.
I pulled a few recipes. So there's one from 1900, the 20th Century Guide for Mixing Fancy Drinks by James C. Maloney. He uses pineapple juice. And then he also says this drink is famous with the English, but I'm guaranteeing he just lifted it from the Johnson book. Yeah. A lot of these bartenders, they just, you'll see a lot of the same notes, variations on it. Again, I think we mentioned at one of the last cocktails that we did that, you know, they didn't give a shit about copyright. So,
yeah,
lift as you want. And then in the Buffet Blue Book, 322 Mixed Drinks from 1912, the recipe also uses pineapple syrup. They say use 1 teaspoonful of Grenadilla, which, as far as I could tell, is a tropical fruit similar to passion fruit.
Okay.
And then 1 teaspoonful of pineapple syrup. They call for Abbott's bitters, you know, pretty similar to the other one. And then Robert Vermeer of Cocktails, How to Mix Them. He was Robert of the Embassy Club. 1922, again, very similar. He also calls for pineapple syrup. So it seems like the recipe that Haig's using is actually the older recipe, the oldest.
Which is good, I think.
But he seems to be saying, well, no, I prefer this one. I don't know.
But they're not being generated spontaneously by all these different guys. They're taking Johnson's and then adjusting it for maybe what they have or what they prefer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like what I feel like I've seen in the Bloody Mary or that Dr. Cocktail, where it seemed like things were just being spontaneously generated independently all over the place.
And that happens all the time with these recipes. You'll just see, like, wild variations.
Well, I mean, in some cases, I think that the names lend themselves, because people will put certain words together, and they think they're being original, but it's already been made, or it's being made, you know, in the same time period. You know, across the country, there could be 2 cocktails with the same name, are completely different and don't even know that each other exist. I feel like when you get a name that is easy, then it's bound to happen. But East India, I feel like the name on this is kind of an homage to the cocktail world and what came out of India.
One of the things that I was thinking of, before I talk about that, one thing that Robert Vermeer points out is that for the Derby cocktail, which is one on the list, is that it's made exactly the same way as the East India cocktail, but the Derby has champagne added. You know, we could say that this was true, that this was something that the British drank, or that the British that living in India at the time were drinking. It could also, as you're saying, an homage. It could be something that they're using the ingredients. If you look at what, you know, if you look at what the ingredients are, you have brandy, which is typically European, and then you have all of these, let's say, tropical ingredients.
Well, raspberry,
pineapple. I mean,
the bitters, yeah, okay. The
bitters, curacao. These are all tropical things, so it could be that they're calling out to India being a tropical, even though that's not necessarily the case. It could just be one of those.
No, you're right. But also, when this cocktail was made, you're saying 1882, when it first came about, that is late in the British time period in India. So, you know, at that point, they've got better transportation. They could probably bring brandy and stuff there. So, you know, maybe there is something to that. But I guess it doesn't fit the profile we've seen with the British and India story. So,
you know, and it was hard to find much more on this drink itself. There's tons of recipes. Tons of recipe books had an East India recipe. They weren't too far off. I didn't see anything that was like, whoa, this is so different. Like, one didn't use raspberry or pineapple syrup, but that was about the extent of the variation. And from there, once I'm finding all these recipes and trying to find the history, I did go on to other books. Sometimes you find references to these in books that are not recipe books. The only place I could really find it, which was interesting, because it took me a while to figure out what I was really reading, and then I had to look at what this organization was. It shows up in a long list of drinks in a poem called Selling Out by Sidney C. Kendall. And it's in a book called The Royal Templar Platform, a collection of readings and recitations for council and lodge,
social entertainments, and public meetings from 1892. So I was like, oh, Royal Templar. What's that? Because when you read the poem, it starts off with somebody whose name is Paddy. I think they were trying to say Moriarty, but it was spelled in a way that of someone who probably doesn't know any Irish people and also doesn't care to. And I think he was supposed to be just a representative of an alcohol problem. And
where did the poem come from?
Canada.
That's the first time from Canada.
So Sidney C. Kendall was a member of the Royal Templar, as far as I could tell.
A Canadian. Okay, that's a Canadian group?
Yes, and it was a temperance group. Once I looked at the poem, I was like, this is such a weird poem, because at first when you read it on first glance, it looked like it was saying, please don't close down my business, and this is my way of life, my father owned this tavern, my grandfather owned this tavern, and look at the service I do. But as you actually look at the poem, it's kind of a slam on tavern owners saying, oh, look at what a good service I provide. In the list, it's like a long list, East India cocktail shows up in there. So, you know, Harry Johnson was U.S. by all rights, and he was an American citizen. He was born in, like, Prussian Germany, you know, but he moved when he was a few years old. So he was by all rights American. I don't know. It's weird that they would pick it out of the list, because I think they had, like, the sidecar and the Manhattan and all standard drinks, but it was like, oh, the East India cocktail. And then I was trying to figure out what they were referring to. It sounds like there was something called the Canada Temperance Act from 1864, which was basically a small step towards prohibition in Canada.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was pretty much it for the drink itself.
Huh, okay.
Now, in terms of the history of the name, that's a hard one, too. You know, right away when I saw East India, I thought of East India Company.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people do. Haig was saying something about the East Indies referred to Burma, Malaya, Singapore, and, you know, other British colonies. Really, though, in a way it's true, but that was a European thing. East Indies was just a term to define South and Southeastern Asia.
Yeah.
As a whole. And it wasn't just the British. There was the Dutch, the French, the Portuguese. Also had territorial and had East India companies.
Yeah.
But the first English East India Company was formed in 1599, and it was to compete with the Dutch trade.
That happened after the English kicked Spanish butt. They beat up the Armada, and then the seas were wide open. So the English said, let's start an empire.
And what's interesting is, because I didn't know a lot about this time period or the East India Company or the British stake in it. I mean, when you think of East India Company, it seems like, well, it's just British. I mean, it's all British. Mm-hmm. But actually, in 1623, there was the Amboina Massacre.
Yeah.
Which sounds like the Dutch came in and kicked the shit out of the English.
Do you want to hear that story?
Tell that story, because I only saw a little bit about it.
Okay, so the Dutch were way ahead of everybody in the whole going around and setting up colonies everywhere. Their East India Company was well established. Yeah. And basically, they had colonies everywhere. The British East India Company started expanding, and they would come into these areas where the Dutch had already settled. Now, you know, it's trade, so it should be open. Everybody should be able to trade with the locals, and you have these competing interests in these same places. So the British went to Indonesia and set up shop there, basically, and were working side by side with the Dutch, the French, and such. But it so happened that a Japanese Ronin... This starts getting crazy. Okay, yeah. Japanese Ronin. A Ronin is a masterless samurai.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they caught a Ronin spying, the Dutch did, their operation. Hmm. And they captured him and tortured him for a confession. And what they did back then was waterboarding. So this is, you know, early waterboarding, and it sounds just like the way we do it now. And the governor, who was Dutch, because they planted roots well before everybody else, Herman van Spoelt, or Spilt, he tortured this guy. This guy admitted to a conspiracy of the Japanese and the English East Indies Trading Company.
Hmm.
They said they were working together, trying to boot the Dutch out. Okay, so Herman wasted no time in gathering up the Japanese in the area and the British East India Trading Company personnel, including their leader Gabriel Towerson. And all these guys were waterboarded, and anybody who admitted to the conspiracy, which many of them did, because when you're being tortured, you just tend to say whatever. Yeah, yes. Just to make it stop.
Right.
Anybody who admitted was charged with treason and beheaded. Gabriel Towerson had his head on display for a while. Mm. And so this was in 1623. So that's basically, 23 years after the company starts? Because it started in 1599, right?
So, okay. Yeah, and clearly it soured their relationship.
They you know, the guys who didn't get executed went back to England and raised a fuss, and it became a massive he said, she said kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
He said, he said, because there were no she's, you know.
Right.
And it messed up the relations further with the English and the Dutch. And what came of it was that the British said, screw this. We're not going to depend on Indonesia that much. Mm-hmm. And they had business in India, but they ramped it up in India.
Yeah.
So they kind of focused over there. Now, this is a part that I find really interesting, because it's not something that I knew. I had no idea that this was true. And if you do research later and find out any of this is wrong, that's fine, because I don't use your methods, and my search is much more cursory. And I don't think that I got into the depth. I think I'm missing a lot of details here. But the East India Trading Company, the British East India Trading Company, grew stronger and more powerful in India, so much so that in 1757, they staged their own battle, the Battle of Plassey, which overthrew the ruling government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way they did this was by conspiring with one of the leader's generals, a Bengalese army commander named Mir Jafar, and it was his job to turn his troops against his confederates at an appointed time within the battle, and that just basically just messed them all up. And the British, they promised him lots of money and the seat as the new ruler of Bengal. They were not sovereigns, they were corporate leadership.
Mm-hmm.
They had, you know, it was like CEOs.
Yeah, like the U.S.
Yeah. It's getting that way, yeah. So, this guy, Mir Jafar, actually, his name, it now means a collaborationist. If you use the word
it's Mir... It's like Benedict Arnold.
Yeah. Is a, huh. Well, but if you use the word Mir Jafar, that means that's what you're referring to. Not specifically the guy, but that kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
What you're referring to now, in 1857, is the rebellion. And
that.
After 100 years of corporate rule, the policies started getting really shitty.
Yeah. Surprise.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, the Indian soldiers, they were some of the biggest mutineers. They were alienated by the corporate policies, like they were losing standing.
Mm-hmm.
As the company got bigger and there was more control, and they actually were expanding their territory into India even more. More Indian natives were being used. And because a lot of these guys initially were on the other side of Mir Jafar, mm-hmm. you know, they were with their original ruler, they kind of weren't seen as necessarily as trustworthy.
Okay.
And so a lot of the Bengalese were, they were demoted in a way. So that was one of the things. Another thing that was really big was they started using, purportedly, it was a rumor, but I don't see why it wouldn't have been true, that they started using animal fat in the cartridges of the rifles that they fired. So what you had to do, and it was, that would be either pig or cow, lard. And you impregnate the paper with it, so it's stiff, and it's also resistant to water.
Okay.
But what you have to do is you have to take it and bite it off with your teeth and pour the powder in.
Okay. Right.
For the Muslims and Hindus in the army, that was a big thing, especially in India. If you were doing that, you were becoming unclean. You were becoming one of the untouchables. Like,
right.
You lost your caste.
Hmm.
So the British were telling him, no, it's not like that, it's not like that. And then when they changed the formula, or they changed how they did it, then even more, they were like, they did do it. Why would they change it if it wasn't? So that was a huge thing for the Indian soldiers. And then the corporate policies also alienated the nobility. They lost all of their titles.
Mm-hmm.
The rural landlords, they were losing their land. And then the peasants, you know, everything just sucked worse for them.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there was a big rebellion. All the people were trying to kick out the East India Trading Company, and so they called in the British government to come help them. And in 1858, that's where
Queen Vicky.
Yeah, Queen. That's where she comes in,
Empress Vicky,
and of she India. Becomes the colonizer. Yeah. So it's no longer a corporate interest; now it's a national interest.
Right,
and that's where the British Raj begins. Mm-hmm. And it lasts until 1947. Right. And initially, huge bloodbath. All the men and young boys in certain parts of India were killed.
At least that's what they said. They had a habit of doing that.
Well, you know, I mean, the chips are down. There's money on the line.
Yeah,
you know?
For real.
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah.
So that's the story of the East India Company. But they were there for... freaking, like...
How many years? 350 years?
I mean, they're in that area since 1600. Mm. So, yeah, you're looking at 350 years where they're there, going back and forth, back and forth. That's where we get pink gin. That was to help with seasickness. Mm-hmm. Gin and tonic, that was to fight malaria. What was it, the Bebo? That kind of, we weren't sure, but it seemed like it may have had a...
That was like sort of a story, but it was hard to tell. I think it was more that we figured it was probably somebody's Italian.
Somebody
last
just
name.
Moving their lips. And then what else? Oh, punch. The word for punch is derived from India, as well as toddy, as in hot toddies. Mm-hmm. That's one possibility. There are others, but it seems like the one that more people think is accurate. And plus, you're getting all the spices and all of these different tropical things. It's a huge part of the cocktail culture. So that's why I'm kind of thinking homage. Now, by 1882, they had faster travel, relatively. It's not like today. So they could have been carrying casks or barrels of brandy and such.
Sure.
And it wouldn't have spoiled, or it wouldn't have been as much of a hardship for them to do that. And there were more wealthy businessmen and administrators and such in India at the time who wanted their brandy and their maraschino and all their sweet
and if you stuff. And by that time as well, I mean, you're looking at, what, 250 years after the Dutch kicked the crap out of the East India Company and said, mm-hmm. They kind of stuck to India. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a long time. And now that you have the British government, they're probably playing a little nicer. It's probably like, hey, look, that was a long time ago. Let's help each other out. Let's open up trade routes. Let's trade brandy. Let's trade all these things. And, mm-hmm. You know, it benefits everybody.
Yeah,
I mean, I think you're right. Because one of the things that I was thinking about as I was doing this research is, how does Harry Johnson know any of this? He wasn't British. He was, I think I mentioned, he was born in Prussian-ruled Germany in the 1840s. Lived in the U.S. from the 1850s. He bounced around like San Francisco, New Orleans, Chicago. And how does he know what the British in India are drinking? And I tried to think, well, you know, news travels. And I do have access to an archive of the Times of India going back to the 1850s.
So, that's awesome.
So
oh my God.
I tried looking in there to see if there was anything, and I really couldn't find anything that talked about cocktails or, you know, it would be a weird thing. I'm not sure that it was the type of publication that would have been reporting on the elite government officials and what their social habits were necessarily.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say. So to me, it does seem, I think you're right, that it probably was more an homage.
And you know that Johnson, I mean, well, maybe he didn't, but I'm assuming that as a cocktail guy, he knows where some of his ingredients are coming from.
Oh, yeah.
He knows that it's not down the block.
Sure. Yeah, it definitely is not coming from down the block.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, that makes the most sense. And so, by all rights, he probably created the drink. And maybe he knew some British people. Maybe he had some British, you know, patrons who asked for it to be made and said, this is what we drink over in the East Indies. You know, it's a weird time.
He just didn't say.
He didn't give any reason why he said this was a favorite of the English in the East Indies. Hmm. Yeah, so I think you're right. I think it's probably a homage.
A homage.
So there you have it, the East India.
Well, that's cool. I learned a lot on this. I really had no idea what the East India Trading Company was all about. I didn't know how many there were, and I didn't know all the politics and stuff that went in. A lot of times when I look at history, I think that it gets boring and muddied once you get the politicians in it, but, I, you know, looking at this, it actually kind of, it was more interesting, seeing it through the glass of a cocktail, so to speak.
No, that's true. I learned a lot as well. I did not know, I mean, I knew of the Dutch East India Company, but it's one of those things I knew about in passing, you know, yeah. I heard it and it didn't really interest me at the time, so I was like,
So. Okay, well, now we're done talking about it. It's time to drink one. So we're going to go to Brixton, and the tasting team is going to drink some.
The East India Cocktail. 3 ounces brandy. 1/2 ounce raspberry syrup. 1 dash Angostura bitters. 1 teaspoon curacao. 1 teaspoon maraschino.
Okay, everyone, it's time to taste a cocktail. So it's the East India cocktail. As you just heard, the East India cocktail, there's a lot associated with the name. Let's just say that. Crazy stories. So I was amazed to discover that India was owned by a corporation for 100 years. I always thought that it was the British government.
I thought you were going to say that you always thought India was free and independent.
Oh, God.
No, I mean, since the 1600s.
No, there wasn't. There
never.
Wasn't.
Never has it been.
I don't think any of the non-Western world was free and independent for... Or really the Western world, for that matter.
That's
true. Thinking about it.
That is true.
I mean, anything that wasn't a healthy jog away from France got the shit kicked out of it. You know, when people started going to... getting on boats.
Going on a walkabout.
Yeah,
I think that's
exactly.
A good way to put it. Yeah. Anything not within jogging distance of France got the shit kicked out. I mean, that's kind of history.
Yeah, it really
summed
is.
Up.
Though Spain really kind of took it on the in the chops for a while. I mean, after the English kicked their ass in the English Channel, they just never recovered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then the U.S. went in... during the Spanish-American War, and the U.S. created these trumped-up charges just to, like, they wanted to try out their new metal boats with the big guns. When they took on the Spanish in the Philippines, the Spanish had wooden ships.
Oh,
like,
really?
Yeah, with the sails and everything. Just
oh,
like,
man.
Yeah, everybody else was using steamships.
No wonder they lost.
It was a great war for the U.S.
We're
so proud. It's like kicking the kid in the wheelchair.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say, I mean, like, should you really be proud of that? It seems like
it was,
not really
it was
a fair
it was
fight.
Teddy Roosevelt's crowning glory.
He wrote a moose.
He did?
Like, really?
Yeah. He did a lot of super manly stuff.
There's a picture of him riding a moose.
You sure it wasn't just Photoshopped?
They didn't have Photoshop then, Cam. And you know what's crazy about it is the moose
Teddy
was
Roosevelt
like,
would have
yeah.
had Photoshop. He alone had Photoshop.
The moose was like, Mr. Roosevelt, I'm honored. Truly honored.
No, the moose was dead.
At the end, maybe.
They propped it up.
He did like to shoot things.
Yeah.
I think he really liked shooting shit.
I think the moose was in water.
He's going through the water on a moose?
I'm gonna need you to share this with the class.
Yeah, that's dead. That's a fucking dead animal. It's floating.
It kind of is. But you know what? Teddy Roosevelt doesn't give any fucks.
No.
He's like, I killed this beast with my bare hands, and then I put it in the water, and I rode upon it.
I'm on a moose, motherfucker. I'm on a moose, and I'm going fast.
I'm going slow, and... I don't even know what... I have to look up the speed of the moose later. I would imagine it goes pretty slow.
European or American?
Well, if it's an African swallow.
Actually, they're straight up called elk.
Elk?
They're still elk and...
Mooses?
European moose. Elk.
Are there really moose in Europe? I don't think
there... Yeah, I think there are, and there is elk.
I think an elk is different from a moose.
No, it is here, definitely.
Do you know that a reindeer and a caribou is the same thing?
Yes.
I didn't know this.
Really?
Really, you didn't?
I didn't know until like a year ago.
I didn't know this.
Really?
Yeah, why? It seems like they would be different.
They're not like even a little bit different?
No, well, here's the thing. It's like all the stuff here,
it's
like
the same
for,
it's two names
for Christmas.
The same
those are all white-tailed deer with red noses.
Yeah.
Those aren't reindeer.
That's a reindeer,
no,
Kevin.
Right. Yeah. They got gnarly, well, like the gardens around here, like they used to have reindeer. You could pet them and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's a reindeer ranch.
You look at it, it looks just like the caribou from the National Geographic.
Kevin, you must have been a real killjoy as a kid. Did you walk around telling people this?
No.
That's not a reindeer.
No, but I was at the Botanic Gardens, and someone's like, look at that beautiful hummingbird, to their child.
Yeah.
And it was a hawk moth. It was like an enormous moth. And I was like, that's a bug.
But, did the child start crying?
You know what? I actually did buy that time. Because it was the size of a hummingbird. Because
actually moths would... They terrify people.
They do.
They will clear my house.
Yeah, you don't want
to. I'm fine with moths, but like everybody else in my house. I mean, they're like flappy.
Yeah.
And quiet. I mean,
they're just like. Yeah.
And they're stealthy
noise.
And
yeah.
And
no, you don't want
they
that
come in
house.
And
they have good camouflage. So they can land next to you, and you're like, did I see it? And then it moves.
And then you freak out.
They gaslight you is what they do. They make you think that they're not there. And then they're there.
Because they fly into the light and then they leave.
That's right.
And they fly back into the light and it's just like you see this like flickering light out of the corner of your eye. You're like, what is that? And then it's gone.
Yeah. Bastard.
Yeah.
Like moth a ninja.
Moths are the gaslighters.
You don't want to put out a moth alarm.
The insect world.
Don't do that at the zoo. Things will get real.
I'm excited to try this cocktail.
Me too. This sounds like a particularly good one.
There's no lime.
No lime.
So
Cam will like it.
So
citrus.
This is already high in the ranks for
it's
Cam.
It's already up there, yeah.
It looks really cool.
It looks beautiful.
The color is gorgeous.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Excuse me, Rick. Mm-hmm.
The East India cocktails have arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they're a gorgeous color.
They're gorgeous.
They are.
We can all agree.
Ooh. Now there's a fuck ton of brandy in there.
Did you try it?
But based upon the ingredients list, we know.
Yeah.
There's a literal fuck ton.
The East India cocktail, it's going to be a sweet one. You know, I think the bitters is an important ingredient in it. The first thing you noticed, I noticed straight away, was 3 ounces of brandy. That's a drink, folks. That's a drink. So you, I guess, always get one or two, and as soon as it's a 3-ounce drink, you get 4 of them. Thinly veiled. Thinly veiled. Having said that, like I said, every component is sweet, with the exception of the bitters. And that's going to add some earth to brandy, which is a pretty earthy spirit.
So, okay.
You know, I imagine it'll drink a lot like a more of a fruity version of a sidecar. Some of the same sweet components, but no sugar. So you substitute the fruit for the sugar, and that's interesting. Then that bitters. I said that's a real interesting ingredient to put in a brandy drink.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing, and tell us what you think about this. In our research, we found out that there were some bartenders back in the day who thought that an olive would go well with this.
I can't imagine adding that rind.
No.
Oh, that sweetness.
You know,
yeah.
Do those same bartenders put olives in their margaritas? Because it's possible.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, then if they give you a martini with a lime in it, run.
Yeah.
No, this is yummy.
Oh, you try it?
Yeah.
Yep.
I haven't tried it yet.
It's good. There's like, it's really good. It's like nice, like there's like a nice sweetness that's overpowering, but there is the fire.
Girl,
stir
it's strong.
It.
Yeah.
Stir it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
It is.
I'm actually not picking up any aroma.
Mm-mm. It just smells like sweet.
I don't
like
even
anything.
Get that.
Really? To me, it just smells like candy.
I get a little candy smell, but barely at all. I mean, it tastes sweet, and then you get the fire in the back of your throat.
That is the brandy. Definitely a drink. It's deceiving. I mean, I really thought it would be sweeter based upon the color.
Yeah, it's colored red, so you thought it would taste like red.
I thought it would taste like red 10.
Like red.
And it does not. But I mean, given what I know about the ingredients, I shouldn't be surprised. And the astonishing amount of brandy in it. Kevin, what do you think?
When you stir it here with the little cherry garnish here, mm-hmm. I like that. Kind of kick up the fruit bit in there.
Okay. Oh,
yeah. Right. It really changes the flavor a lot.
Oh, okay. Good idea.
It does make it less abrasive.
Absolutely.
I'm not getting the same kind of abrasion.
No?
I'm not getting abraded like you are, I don't think.
What about, are you, Kevin, are you feeling, are you feeling offended?
There's some warmth, though.
Yes, but it is good for a night like tonight.
But it's not burning like at the back of my tongue, kind of like brandy does, straight.
No.
And it's nearly straight.
Pretty much, no. Yeah.
It's brandy with
coke. I like this. I like how we pointed out. You know, usually we do, we share cocktails for, I mean, lately, you know, that Bethany's joined us, you know, four is a nice round number. We usually get each one, but like in the past, we've shared cocktails and we, you know, kind of spread them out. This time it's like, no, we each
all
want
of
one.
I want
the boozy cocktail.
Hey, man.
I want my own.
It's like not
I'd like to get kicked
out.
In the head.
Yeah. But you know what? For as boozy as it is,
I don't get
I would have more than one.
And it's
yeah.
very easy drinking. For being so
it is.
Oh
it
yeah. Because like by the time the alcohol flavor and the fire has left the back of your tongue, you're like, ooh, I want some more.
Yeah, it also it definitely does yeah. get easier as you drink more.
Yes.
Right.
Like the first sip
I've already had
very shocked.
Five sips,
yeah.
So, yeah.
The first sip it was kind of a lot.
And then I stirred it right after the first one and I saw it kick up all the little fruit particulate in there. And I was like,
if this
there we go.
If somebody gave one of these to me.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would ask for another.
Yeah.
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 Then you would have a wicked buzz.
Yeah.
You would. Yeah, you'd be done for the night.
But I wouldn't have expected it.
Mm-mm.
No.
Mm-mm. Oops. It's a pretty basic.
I think Michael's right, though. The bitters. I think the bitters makes it.
It's five ingredients, too. So if that counts as making it into a punch.
And if you don't like the raspberry syrup,
mm-hmm.
you can do pineapple syrup.
Sure.
Which is what they were doing instead of raspberry.
I remember when I went to visit Hawaii, I ate so much pineapple. I got sores inside my mouth. Because when you're there and it's so fresh, it's
yeah.
like eating
you just
candy.
Gotta eat it, yeah.
It's like eating candy because it's so sweet.
Yeah.
And it's not like the yellow pineapple out of the jar or out of the can.
No,
yeah. It's like white.
But then there's also the added benefits of pineapple that I've heard of.
Yes, I've heard of this.
I don't know. I don't know
about this.
I haven't tested it
but
myself.
But I've heard about it.
Maybe.
I've heard about it enough. It, I think
that
it's
it lives
real.
In.
The
semen.
Yeah. The yeah.
Yes. Sailors. Sailing to Hawaii.
No.
No. No way.
Yes, we come to the Rickson every Tuesday.
Come some more. When we were at. Apparently vanilla beans do the same thing.
Really?
And like maybe even like cinnamon.
I guess celery to help still.
So you can
celery?
Take the cinnamon challenge and have some.
Does that work for the cinnamon red hot whiskey?
I doubt that.
Oh, because that's like pure poison. What is that called? Fireball.
Yeah, fireball.
I've heard Euros has an opposite effect.
Fireball and whiskey.
You want to hear something gross? I haven't mentioned that I'm from Pittsburgh enough on this podcast. For Christmas, Iron City, which is like the PBR of Pittsburgh, just came out with a fireball beer.
Oh.
Like a cinnamon red hot beer.
You know what the boardroom was like. It was like, why not? What the hell have we got to lose?
Love it.
What the hell have we got to lose? You know.
And I didn't see anyone drinking it. I didn't. Everywhere I saw it, like the display, it was completely full. Like I don't think people are going for it.
They probably made money making it. Somebody paid them to do it.
Yeah.
And they were like,
no one had to actually buy it.
Yeah, okay.
It was like government subsidized.
The cinnamon people. The cinnamon lobby. The cinnamon lobby of Western Pennsylvania. I would be curious to try this with pineapple and see if it did get... I mean, because it's not very sweet as is, which I think is what kind of initially surprise me.
Oh, okay.
We're having the orange crisp now mm-hmm. and the maraschino liqueur.
It really is not sweet like at
and
all.
And like a fruit syrup in it. Mm-hmm. It's not terribly sweet. Mm-hmm. I think it's counteracted by how much brandy is in it. Kind
yeah,
of,
and
like,
the bitters.
And the bitters. Mm-hmm. But like the sheer amount of how much brandy is in it kind of like overpowers.
Obliterates everything.
Yeah.
Which is not bad in this case. No. I mean, I'm not a huge brandy drinker,
but... you know, it definitely isn't like drinking straight brandy.
No, it's not.
It's nothing like it.
No.
I mean, you told him not a huge brandy.
It's like all the good things about brandy.
She's a fine girl.
What a good drink she would be.
So, everyone.
Yes.
Brandy. Fine drink.
East India cocktail.
Delicious.
Thumbs up.
Would have again. Would have A++. Would have... Oh god! Plus, if you have two of these, I think you would be like.
If you had two of these, you'd be set.
Yeah, like getting drunk.
Set into something.
Something. Like, drinking drunk.
If you're gonna have two, have something to eat.
Yeah.
It's a
or have a bed nearby.
If this is on something. The cocktail list at your local watering hole,
yes,
you could order two and be done for the evening.
Yeah.
So.
And thank you to the fine people of the Brixton for making sure that, first of all, making this delicious drink, and secondly, giving us food so we don't die. Yeah. Because this is, like, super intense.
Yep.
Yes, thank you, Michael.
Good stuff.
He's a scholar and a gentleman.
It's true.
He's a bartender and a gentleman.
It's all of the above.
It's all of the above. Okay.
Rachel's done, and she...
So, I guess we're going to wrap it up, because we're all just kind of puddles. Because this is a fucking strong drink. Okay, so...
It's delicious.
Check us out. Facebook, Twitter. If you like the art. The art is awesome. Have you seen the art? The art's really good.
True.
We've got the whole set of art out of Pinterest. And otherwise... Oh! I just have to say...
What's that, Cam?
Some awesome shows coming up.
Oh.
Like,
oh.
Some of the history coming up.
Oh, snap!
Behind the cocktails that we're tasting is... fucking incredible. Like,
excellent.
Like real people, real lives in an old world.
Nice.
This is history through a cocktail glass. And working with Jason Cruz has been such a treat because he knows so much, and you know, when I sit and talk with him about it, we both start realizing the full story. He adds his bit, I add my bit, and then we're both like, oh shit. And then we have a good time with it. So keep listening, because there's some really cool episodes coming up. Until next week, this is Cameron Marceau with Black Liver Project. If you're into thinking and drinking, let us blacken your liver. Bye now. Hey everybody, thanks for listening to the Monster in a Glass podcast. I'd like to thank Jason Cruz for researching our content, our regular tasting team Rachel Rubin, Kevin Ratajczyk, Bethany Lang, and Nicole Pizzini for joining me in the grueling task of tasting the cocktails we discuss, the Brixton and their bartender Michael Donnelly for letting us cavort in their liquid playground, Dan Cruz for art direction and editing, and Mark Piani for the music at the head of the show. Go to blackliverproject.com to see the show archive, become a member, contribute to the project, and get in touch with us. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get the latest news and, as it happens, updates during live events. And as always, if you're into thinking and drinking, let us blacken your liver. Take a turn around the capstan.